Inconceivable!
Will you please act like you have more than a two-word vocabulary?
Is there air? You don't know!
Hey, don't touch that dial. You found Secular Yakking.
I'm Robert.
And I'm Amy.
After years.
Many years of yakking at each other.
We're here to yak at you.
So sit back and enjoy the yakking.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Hope you had a wonderful weekend.
Yes, this one, I think, was a little calmer than last weekend, so it was better.
Definitely calmer.
Yeah. Still busy, but nowhere near to last weekend, so it's good.
Right.
Some people have it good, some don't.
Yeah.
Everyone's different. Hence, melting pot of America. I'm not going to go on that. Let's okay. go.
Guess what today is?
Do tell.
It is someone's birthday.
Yes, I know exactly whose birthday it is.
Whose birthday is it?
Our identical twin daughter, Sweet 16.
Oh, yeah. There's that. Yeah.
Oh, just, okay. Yeah.
There's also one of the greatest science educators of all time.
Uh-huh.
Carl Sagan.
Of course, I knew that.
Yeah, sure you did.
I did because we planned that.
That's only because I've been telling you for the past week.
No, we planned it. I'm telling you. That and our oldest daughter's Earth Day on her birth. So we're schedulers.
Yes, I know.
Except I hate scheduling. You like schedules. I like just spontaneity, and you can't stand that.
Yeah, that's annoying.
No, totally need spontaneity.
Yeah, okay, whatever. Anyway, on with the plan.
Yes, Carl Sagan.
So Carl Sagan was American astronomer, cosmologist, astrophysicist, astrobiologist, author, science popularizer, and science communicator.
Mouthful.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you actually said that without chirping.
His contributions were central to the discovery of high surface temperatures on Venus. However, he is best known for his contributions to scientific research of extraterrestrial life.
Yes.
Sagan assembled the first physical messages that were sent into space on the Pioneer plaque and the Voyager Golden Record.
Oh, uh-huh.
Universal message that could potentially be understood by any extraterrestrial intelligence that might find them.
Never had any luck with that, huh?
No,
but...
Those things just now got out of the solar system.
Of course. But, yeah, I mean, I guess for me, I mostly, you know, recognize him and knew him from his TV show. Because, you know, that's the thing I was into.
Right. So, he also wrote many popular science books, including Dragon's Eden, Bocca's Brain, Pale Blue Dot, and one of my favorites, A Demon Haunted World.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
And narrated.
Very passionate, by the way.
He is very passionate.
Extremely passionate about all that he did.
Right. He also co-wrote the 1980 television series Cosmos.
That's the one I know so much.
That was my first introduction to any science at all.
Yeah, I used to do a lot of school things because of, you know, on the Cosmos and stuff. It was a lot of reports I did, and I would use the Cosmos to do my reports with.
Right. I remember sitting in first grade watching Cosmos.
Yeah.
It was just absolutely amazing. Even as a first grader, I understood it was still boring, right? Because it was really science-y.
No, see, for me...
But I understood why it was important, and I did enjoy it.
Yeah. I don't think I watched Cosmos as a first grader, at least that I remember. I'm sure I caught some of his shows, but for me, the only science-y show that I remember watching was Doctor Who.
And Doctor Who.
The Muppets. Not the science part, but as far as the science part, it was Doctor Who.
Doctor Who.
I mean, come on. I was a first grader.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, and Sesame Street. That's educational.
Right. That is, yeah.
But, yeah.
I grew up watching those cool shows.
Yeah, I think I remember catching Cosmos during elementary school, but not until I was a little older that I actually started using it for school.
Right. Anyway, in Cosmos, he created what I believe is probably one of the best messages ever for humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think we should listen to that.
Okay.
Those worlds in space are as countless as all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the Earth. Each of those worlds is as real as ours. In every one of them, there's a succession of incidents, events, occurrences, which influence its future. Countless worlds, numberless moments, an immensity of space and time. And our small planet, at this moment, here we face a critical branch point in history What we do with our world right now will propagate down through the centuries and powerfully affect the destiny of our descendants. It is well within our power to destroy our civilization and perhaps our species as well, if we capitulate to superstition or greed or stupidity. We can plunge our world into a darkness deeper than the time between the collapse of classical civilization and the Italian Renaissance. But we are also capable of using our compassion and our intelligence, our technology and our wealth, to make an abundant and meaningful life for every inhabitant of this planet, to enhance enormously our understanding of the universe, and to carry us to the stars.
So that's one of the best messages I think he put out.
That's funny that you say that, because that one I do totally remember.
Yeah.
I remember that one quite well, actually.
Yeah, it's that one and the Pale Blue Dot. Those are probably his most, most well-known.
Yeah, I remember that one really well, too. Yeah.
He died in 1996 of December.
Oh, it was.
He had cancer for a while, and then he died of pneumonia.
Oh.
And interesting, he died right here at the... Seattle at the Cancer Research.
Don't look at me for
help. I had it written down now.
Don't look at me for help. It's gone. But no, I think that's kind of interesting. This was in 96?
Yeah, 96.
Yeah.
And in 1997, the movie Contact, which was based off the book he wrote, was finished. And at the end, there's a dedication to him that says, yes. For Carl.
Yes, I love that movie, by the way.
Yeah, it's an awesome movie.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
So yeah, Carl Sagan is definitely one of my most favorite science educators.
Yeah, it would be interesting if he could see, you know, what we've accomplished now, you know, so far, and his thoughts would be.
I think he would be rather impressed with what we've done.
Yeah, I would think so. I would hope so.
In some ways.
Greatly disappointed in others. Yeah, absolutely.
But I think we shall move on with some science.
Yes, let's do.
So NASA announces Mars' atmosphere was stripped away by solar winds.
So, meaning it
used to have an atmosphere.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It used to have one, and the solar winds slowly ate away at it.
Right. So, a few billion years ago, the atmosphere of Mars was protected by its magnetosphere.
Right.
Because it had a magnetic core.
I can't help it. You explained this to me earlier, but every time I hear that, I can't think of the X-Men.
So Magneto's got a sphere there?
It just goes in my head over and over, and I got to kind of weed that out and listen to what you're saying.
So, yeah, the magnetosphere, which keeps these solar winds, which are ionized particles, from blowing away the atmosphere. It's what keeps our atmosphere in place, is our very, very powerful magnetosphere.
Right, exactly.
So once the atmosphere blew away, the water evaporated into space.
Well, that's inevitable, obviously. Right.
So according to the scientists, and using the MAVEN, the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution, is what it's called.
Did you get that spacecraft? Out okay?
Yeah, I think so. It has been orbiting Mars since 2014, and last year a probe was lucky enough to be able to observe
blah, blah, blah.
The direct impact of a solar storm in Mars' atmosphere and showed that the solar particles were energizing the gases in the upper atmosphere, causing them to blast into space and likely out of the solar system.
Right.
So, according to what they said, Mars had a mostly habitable environment billions of years ago. I'm not sure how many billions. But
right, so it's basically on its way out as far as where we're like in the middle of our prime, I guess you could say.
Right.
Their planet
is
done and gone and going, They're not gone, but they're
a barren wasteland. That leads me to think that there was life on Mars at one point in time. Microorganisms.
Right, exactly. You kind of can't help but assume that, you know? I mean, it's kind of like how you would see this planet going one day, you know,
magnetosphere ever fails.
Right. It's kind of the pattern that I would assume a planet falls through.
Right.
You know, you have somewhat,
well,
not habitable per se, but
we have a lot more mass than Mars, right? Yeah. So our iron core is much bigger. It's going to take way longer.
But I meant as far as, you know, you had what could possibly have held life of some kind, and then you slowly lose that, and it, you know, turns into a barren wasteland. And then after this step, we won't even be able to set foot on it if it continues, because it'll be like all the other planets where you can't even touch it.
Right.
If we could get to them. But yeah,
yeah, like, I mean, like Venus, we can't do anything with Venus.
Right. So it's working the other way, though.
Venus went the other way.
Yeah.
Greenhouse gases in Venus.
Right.
Too much atmosphere.
Exactly.
So, but that's really cool.
We're too perfect.
Yep. We're 10 foot one way, 10 foot the other. We wouldn't have a planet.
Because we have God to thank for that.
I've actually seen that argument.
I know, and it's disgusting.
Anyway, on to more, not more interesting, but differently interesting.
Okay.
A little bit of psychology here.
All righty.
Atheist children more altruistic than religious children.
That does not surprise me one iota. To honk my own horn, toot, toot. Yeah, I'm telling you, it just doesn't.
An international study has found children in religious families are meaner than their godless peers.
That's sad, but true.
The report published in the journal Current Biology challenges notions that equate piety and charity.
With charity. But yeah, I've, you know, with having three kids in public school, you know, in high school even, and, you know, I see it time and time again. I see the differences in behaviors of, you know, my kids and kids who are also non-religious that are friends of theirs versus the kids who are. And there is seriously behavioral differences.
Yeah, there's absolutely.
And how they treat others. Oh my gosh, the way they treat others, it's phenomenal. I mean, I can just, when my daughter calls me on the phone from the bus, I can just listen to that.
Right.
And that's just a tiny little bit. So I know for a fact that this is a very true statement.
Right. Well, in the study, they had more than 1,100 kids between the ages of 5 and 12, and they were asked to share stickers with anonymous schoolmates. Mm-hmm. They lived in North America, Middle East, South Africa, and included Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, and Hindus.
Okay. So all branches.
Right. Well, so pretty much.
Many branches.
A huge.
Diversity,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Those from agnostic and atheist households consistently prove less likely to keep the best stickers for themselves.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. The more religious parents, the less altruistic the children, irrespective of the religion.
Right.
Right. A phenomenon dubbed moral licensing, where people's perception that they were doing good, in this case practicing religion, exempted them from the obligation to perform other worthy deeds.
Huh. I say this time and time again, I see this all the time. And, you know, when you're having conversations or arguments or whatever with, you know, religious, and they're always ragging on the, you know, people who don't believe in a God or, you know, are just non-religious. And they're constantly saying, well, you're immoral and you can't have morals.
Here's the thing. They say, well, we give to charity. We give all the time.
Okay, yeah, that too.
You're giving to a church. You're giving 10% to your church.
Right.
That's not necessarily the right. That's not the charities we're giving to.
Well, and as you can see, whenever something tragic happens, the biggest numbers that are put out are usually put out by non-religious people when it comes to donating and helping.
Yeah, individual numbers, right?
Yeah,
not as far as the total. The total, of course, not higher.
Because, I mean, come on. You know, look how many churches there are versus, you know, non-religious people.
Right.
You're talking mass numbers, but as far as percentages why per person or just percentages per group and whatnot, you always have the non-religious just shoving out everything they can possibly do.
Right.
Whereas you don't pull those kind of numbers from the religious.
Right.
You just don't.
Right. Well, and then we have a couple of major things going on here, especially from the secular community. We got Foundation Beyond Belief.
Right.
Those guys are awesome. They do all sorts of amazing work all over the world.
Yes.
And then if you want to look at like local stuff, like the Austin Atheist Community, mm-hmm. they've got the Atheist Helping the Homeless campaign.
Right.
Which they give out toiletries to homeless people once a week, and they don't give them Bible tracts while they do it.
That's the one thing that drives me nuts about, you know, when you do have the religious or Christian or what have you, you know, when they give out help of in any form, they always have to give you a pamphlet with it. And right. it might be a paper or it might be verbal.
Right.
Where, you know, they just they can't just do something to do a good thing. They have to get their little preaching in with it.
Well, and there's something else interesting that this study found, which they found that children were shown videos of, you know, minor offenses, like bumping into people or pushing each other.
Okay.
The religious kids were more inclined to decide harsh punishment for those people.
Yes, I've seen that actually.
Right. Yes. So they're more likely to want to punish more.
Right.
Whereas the atheist and agnostic children are more likely to forgive minor offenses.
Well, and I have to say also, you know, as a parent, you know, it's not just about the punishment, too. For me, I guess it is. It's about, yes, they're going to get punished, but it's going to be according to whatever the crime was. It has to match that, as well as explain, you know, you did this, and this is why this is happening. So that it's something that they learn from. With a lot of religious families I see around here, a lot of times it's just, like, brutal, like, for, you know, something very, very simple, and they're getting, like, this ridiculous punishment for it, and nothing else is said about right. it. But for me, I think, personally, it's about make the punishment fit the crime and also discuss the process of how you got from here to there.
Right.
You know, and then...
We'll discuss why it's wrong.
Well, that's more of what I mean. It's
not,
exactly.
And it's not wrong because the Bible says so or because some authoritarian says so.
No,
it's wrong because it hurts someone or it has caused damage to something.
That is exactly what I'm talking about. The process of how we got from here to here. You know, the what they did, what you did, how you responded, and how now you're here. Go through that and explain why, because you chose this and, you know, you didn't think about this, you know, how it would affect, say, so-and-so before you made this decision, and this is where we are now. You know, right. that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now, trust me, by any means, I am not one who... I also see those parents who just kind of talk to the kids, now, little Johnny, would you like to go do this or would you like to go do that?
Right.
You know, as far as their punishment or, you know, just please stop hitting your sister's head up against the wall. And, you know, talking to them real right. sweet. I'm like, hell no. No. Knock that crap off right now or you will get your butt in this position.
That just reminded
so,
me.
I mean.
That reminded me of remember the show, I think it's Who's the Boss? With Tony Danza?
Yes, yes.
There was an episode that sticks in my head every time. And the mother was learning about alternative punishments.
Really? I don't remember that.
Right. And so the kid was kind of annoying, right? And he was using a broom to do something that he shouldn't do, right?
Uh-huh.
And part of the thing was to get them to do something else.
Yes.
And he was using a broom and he was knocking down stuff off shelves and stuff.
Right.
And she comes in and she gets all flustered and says, broom elsewhere.
Okay.
You just reminded me of that and I thought it was really funny.
You're really weird.
I am really weird.
You're just weird.
All right.
Anyways, that could be like a whole nother thing all on its own.
I know. Anyway, here's something cool. Chimp psychologist Dr. Zira from Planet of the Apes to discuss human behavior on Monmouth University.
I'm sorry. It's Dr. Zeta. Dr. Zayas.
Dr. Zayas, Dr. Zayas.
I can't help it. That's all I hear is all right, Dr. Zayas.
Listen, and
sorry,
you'll find out
go,
why.
Go.
In a lecture performance, Dr. Zira draws the cutting-edge research in the fields of neuroscience, primatology, and evolutionary biology to interpret the predatory activities of human beings in post-industrial societies in the world. Dr. Zira is a chimpanzee psychologist and veterinarian who specializes in the study of humans.
Okay, you have to stop because I can't get past the name. I hear that, and I hear Dr. Zayas, and I zone out. So okay. Translate what you just said.
So Dr. Zira is talking about human as they interact in the wild.
Right, of course.
Right? So...
But come on.
Okay, I got to come clean on this. This is actually performance art.
What do you mean?
By award-winning Cuban-American artist and author Cuco Fusco, titled Observation of Predation of Humans. She portrays Dr. Zira, the female chimpanzee and animal psychologist from the 1968 film Planet of the Apes.
I am awesome. I can't believe you did that.
Yeah, the lecture is part of an Art Now Visiting Artist series that supports emerging art forms. She explains, I became interested in Zira's character. She's an animal psychologist who studies the human brain, a pacifist intellectual who constantly points out problematic aspects of human behavior.
Uh-huh.
In the original film, the focus on critique of human is on their aggressive tendencies, their capacity to kill each other, their use of weapons of mass destruction, etc. I started to think about how I might revive her and have her explore other dimensions of human behavior.
So I'm not insane.
No, you got it. So Dr. Zira was... Dr. Zira...
I can't.
...was the fiancé of Cornelius.
Right, exactly. Right?
And Dr. Zaius was on the other side. He was the orangutan that was against
it. He was it.
Basically against humanity.
Right.
So yeah, you got it absolutely right.
Oh, good. So it's not just me going nuts, because this was just too much. I
wanted to throw that in.
It was too close.
It's I thought it was really cool, and it looks like it's going to be a really cool thing to watch. I'm going to see if I can find some videos of it, but I'll post a link to the actual performance.
Oh, so this is going to be an actual
thing. This is an actual thing at Monmouth University. I found this, and I'm like, oh, that is so cool.
Well, you know, I know how you find these stories, and, you know, we go over them, and we just mostly talk about titles. We don't really go through them. And this one, we didn't go through more than we don't normally go through.
No, I just told you the title.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm getting to the point where, okay, let's just tell me this title, and, you know, we'll do a vague talk, and then, you know, you can explain a little bit, but I'm not really listening, so let's move on. But for that one, I could not get past the whole Planet of the Apes thing.
It was Planet of the Apes.
And I couldn't focus on what the hell you were saying.
But I think it's very much into actual psychology.
No, yes, totally.
So that's kind of why I wanted to put it in. Because it was an interesting story, right? And I thought we might have a little comedy out of it. So.
Well, got me on that one.
You're not talking to somebody else around here, are you? You know, this is me. You remember me? George Bailey.
So... this week, we've changed up the Potter Award just a little bit.
I kind of like this.
So what we decided is we focus a lot on negatives with the Potter Award.
Yeah, and you know how I feel about negatives.
Right. So I thought we would go out and actively search for George Bailey's.
Yes.
And if you're familiar with the movie, George Bailey was the protagonist in the movie, in which he was so selfless. He gave everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he gave up pretty much his entire
dreams. He was a good person.
Right. He was... So, and that's why I think once a month.
Well, I was just going to say, we will be trying to do the George Bailey Award just once a month. We will be sticking with Mr. Potter Award on our normal, regular basis. But once a month, we're going to try and squeeze in a George Bailey.
Right.
Probably because of me, because I'm all about the positive.
Well, and to be honest, sometimes it's hard to find someone who's worthy of the Potter Award.
Well... not entirely. I'm sorry. There's so much more Potter than there are Baileys.
Right. But I would like to start highlighting these Baileys.
And we should. I mean, by far, we should definitely be highlighting the positive, not just the negative.
Right.
I feel like there's a song coming on or something. Oh, I know the song. I'm not going there.
You can't sing that song. But, I didn't pay for the rights for that.
Okay, I'm not going to go there, but it's now stuck in my head.
Yeah, I know.
So that's all I'm going to hear. But no, I definitely think we should do this. And once a month by far. I mean,
okay.
Breaks up the monotony as well.
Yes, it does. So, and this being a science show,
mm-hmm.
I actively found a scientist.
Well, that's very, very convenient of you.
Our first George Bailey Award is going to the only PhD in the United States Congress.
Oh, really?
Illinois 11th District Congressman Bill Foster.
Okay.
He has a PhD in physics, and before he became a politician, he worked for the Fermi National Laboratory smashing protons and antiprotons together.
Mm, wow.
So kind of cool stuff. He also observed neutrinos from a supernova.
Wow.
So he's like, yeah, real physicist.
Right, exactly.
But he's much more than that.
Right. Okay.
As a politician, he has a unique position to promote science from a legislative level.
No, that's good.
So, and Neil deGrasse Tyson talked about it. He mentioned how most of the Congress are lawyers, and I've got some audio for that.
I said, oh, I wonder what profession all these senators and congressmen were. Law, 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 businessman, law, law. And I said, there are no scientists? Where are the engineers? Where's the rest of life?
So, yeah. That was on a Bill Maher episode a couple years ago.
Oh, okay.
So and I remember that when I was looking at this, Neil deGrasse Tyson said something about that, so I went and grabbed it.
Uh-huh.
But, and he's not just that. So he's a congressman with a physics PhD in physics.
Right.
He's a science proponent, obviously.
Obviously.
But recently, he spoke in the House, floor of the House of Representatives, recognizing RoboGals.
Okay.
A student robotics team from Aurora, Illinois, who won the national championship in Detroit and will be competing in the World Robotic Olympiad in Qatar this November.
Cool.
So, and I have that too.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today in honor of the triumph of the RoboGals, a student robotics team from the 11th Congressional District of Illinois. The RoboGals are Kaya Hollister, a fifth grader at the John C. Dunham STEM Partnership School, and Jensi Coonrad, a fourth grader at the Wheatland Elementary School, both in Aurora, Illinois. They met on an after-school robotics club hosted by Chasewood Learning, an educational organization that uses Lego robots to teach students how to build and program their machines for competition. After winning the regional competition at SciTech Hands-On Museum in Aurora, Illinois, the RoboGals went on to win the national championship of the World Robotic Olympiad in Michigan. Now, they advanced to the World Championship round in Qatar, taking on over 50 countries from all over the globe, and I, together with all Americans, wish them the best of luck. The RoboGals are an inspiration to young women across our country who are enthusiastic about science and engineering. And the 11th Congressional District is proud to have such bright young women representing our country on the global stage. Thank you, and I yield back.
I find that absolutely amazing. Yeah, I mean, they're fourth and fifth grade.
Yeah, that's absolutely really cool. They're making robots out of Legos.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and he took time from the Congress to recognize that.
Yes, which is nice. I mean, they talk all the time about how, we're losing, our up-and-coming scientists.
And not just scientists, but female scientists.
Female scientists for sure. But they're not also encouraging it or right. putting it out there for these young kids to see and have that in their life. If they're not exposed to it, they're not going to, know to have that desire unless they have that influence within their circle,
Right.
But if it was in, more things like government and whatnot, it was more in your face, I guess, right. they would be exposed to it more
right.
often.
Which is why I'm glad he's doing at least a little something, right?
Right.
But remember, you have to be selfless to get the award.
Okay.
You have to give of yourself.
Right, right? Okay.
And he did.
Okay.
During the government shutdown of 2013, he donated all the pay he received during that time to the Illinois Food Bank,
Oh.
So back in 2013, remember the government shut down?
Yes.
A lot of people didn't get paid for weeks.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, but Congress continued to get paid.
Yes.
Which frustrates me.
Yes.
And it frustrated him as well because he said this. I do not believe members of Congress should receive a paycheck while people in Illinois and throughout the country were suffering because the Congress failed to do their job. I was pleased to be able to donate my pay to the Northern Illinois Food Bank and support the important work they do feeding the hungry throughout Northern Illinois.
So he puts his words where his mouth
is. Yes.
I mean, that made no sense. he puts actions behind his words. He isn't just all talk.
Right. So he gave.
Yes.
What he got in for that couple weeks, for that like 3 weeks.
Right. Right. Exactly. And the fact that, like he said, nobody else was getting paid, but yet, and because of the job they were supposed to be doing, but yet they're getting paid. And yet it was their fault as to why that all fell apart.
Right.
And I think that's fantastic. And it's really nice to see someone who actually puts actions instead of just talking to us.
I agree.
Because you hear talking, but no action.
Right. And that's why he is our first George Bailey Award winner.
I think it's fantastic. And we will definitely keep up with this because I like this.
Yeah. And I thought we would close out today with one more message from Carl Sagan.
Alrighty.
And it's one of my favorites.
Alrighty.
The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. Our contemplations of the cosmos stir us. There's a tingling in the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation as if a distant memory of falling from a great height. We know we are approaching the grandest of mysteries. The
The size and age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding, lost somewhere between immensity and eternity. Is our tiny planetary home, the Earth. For the first time, we have the power to decide the fate of our planet and ourselves. This is a time of great danger, but our species is young and curious and brave. It shows much promise. In the last few millennia, we have made the most astonishing and unexpected discoveries about the cosmos and our place within it. I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. We wish to pursue the truth no matter where it leads. But to find the truth, we need imagination and skepticism both. We will not be afraid to speculate. But we will be careful to distinguish speculation from fact. The cosmos is full beyond measure of elegant truths, of exquisite interrelationships, of the awesome machinery of nature. The surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. On this shore, we've learned most of what we know. Recently, we've waded a little way out, maybe ankle deep, and the water seems inviting. Some part of our being knows this is where we came from. We long to return. And we can't, because the cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are a way for the cosmos to know itself.
That's all the yakking we have for you tonight. Join us again next week as we resume the assault against your eardrums. If you can't seem to get enough of us, check out our Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. If you like what you hear, drop by our Patreon page and help support the show. Then head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and leave us that coveted 5-star review. And remember, the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. That's the end of the show.
Is
then,
it?
Yeah, and then I'll go out.
Well, I was you just going to say, I wish more people had his mindset, because I think the world would be like Sliders and it would be different.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.